Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
On Friday, October 24th, the Norris Group proudly presents its 7th annual award-winning black tie event, I Survived Real Estate. An incredible lineup of industry experts will join Bruce Norris to discuss perplexing industry trends, head-scratching legislation, and opportunities emerging for real estate professionals. Proceeds for the event benefit Make-A-Wish and St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. This event could not have been possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners: Auction.com, HousingWire, Property Radar, the Apartment Owners Association, the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association and President Bill Tan, Invest Club for Women and Iris Veneration, San Jose Real Estate Investors Association and Geraldine Berry, MVT Productions, and White House Catering. For event information, visit isurvivedrealestate.com.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is Christopher Thornburg. Christopher is founding partner of Beacon Economics and widely considered to be one of California's leading economists, an expert in economic forecasting, regional economies, labor markets, economic policy, and industry and real estate analysis. He was one of the earliest and most adamant predictors of the subprime mortgage market collapse and of the global economic recession that followed in 2008. Dr. Thornburg serves on the advisory boards of Paulson & Company, Inc., one of Wall Street's leading hedge funds, and of the Los Angeles Area Chamber of Commerce, Southern California's largest not-for-profit business federation. Between 2008 and 2012, he served as chief economic advisor to the California State Comptroller's Office and was chair of Comptroller John Chiang's Council of Economic Advisors. Dr. Thornburg holds a PhD in business economics from the Anderson School of UCLA and a BS in business administration from the State University of New York, Buffalo. Christopher, welcome to our show.
Welcome to it. I've been here many times, Bruce. This is our annual conversation, isn't
it? Welcome back to probably our fifth time. I was going to ask you, what did you make of $84 oil, but I never got a chance to. So what do you make of $82 oil, and does that signal anything?
Well, look, we know that the global economy is having some issues. China has been slowing down. Europe, of course, is having trouble getting out of the doldrums they've been in. They're in some political turmoil, and lo and behold, some of these commodity markets have really floundered. But I think it's important to keep in mind that commodity markets tend to overreact to everything, right, on the high end and on the low end. And you know, my guess is while some of the numbers out there are frustrating, ultimately the sell-off is probably going to come to an end in the near future, and the numbers will start bouncing back towards 100 again. We know, of course, this big swing producer in OPEC, Saudi Arabia, aims for that number, and you know, worst case scenario, they'll start turning off pumps in order to try and push that number a little bit higher. But ultimately, I tend not to look at any of the commodity markets or the stock market and pretend that these kind of week-to-week fluctuations mean much from an economic standpoint, because they're just excessively volatile given how those markets work.
Just in general, though, does the global economy really affect what happens in the United States, and does that affect the specific market of real estate?
Yes and no is the answer to that, which, of course, being an economist, that's exactly how I'm supposed to answer everything, right? You're 100% correct that the U.S. Is, A, fairly isolated from all that. I mean, keep in mind that the U.S. is over 20% of the global economy. And, of course, our two neighbors, Mexico, Canada, also fairly large economies. We're our own sort of block, if you will, here in North America, that is somewhat isolated from the broader global trends simply because we mainly trade with each other. You know, we hear about Japan and China all the time, but keep in mind that our biggest large trading partners are Canada and Mexico.
Okay.
But putting that to one side, it does have a couple bits of influence. And one of the ways, of course, is we are seeing a little bit of diminishment in the demand for U.S. products. Exports have more or less flattened, even though imports continue to rise. And that's definitely a weakness for the U.S. economy at some level. Indeed, if you wanted to consider the slowdown in the U.S. economy in the first half of the year compared to what was happening last year, it almost exclusively is due to the widening of the trade deficit, which can be linked to that trade trends. The second part of it, of course, has to do with interest rates and money, and the exchange rate, as the case may be.
Okay.
A lot of folks, of course, are now expecting that the Federal Reserve will be tightening way before any of the other major central banks. The dollar is starting to come up as a result of that. And at some level, that means you may start to see slightly less money coming into the United States in terms of investment, just because we're not as good of a deal anymore. But on the other hand, with the U.S. economy growing and other places not so much, you may see more money pouring into the U.S. economy because we are starting to look like one of the safe havens. And indeed, you know, you think about what we're seeing here in California, particularly here in Southern California, over the last couple of years has been a massive wave of money from China. Now, whether that's fleeing corruption, whether that's looking for better returns, whether that's people trying to hide their ill-begotten earnings, I don't know, but the numbers across the board, from EB-5 investment to official investment to the unofficial home purchase investment, the money is just flooding here, and the slowdown in China doesn't seem to be slowing down the movement of capital here.
Is this type of flow of money reminiscent of the Japanese real estate boom and their flooding our market with their money in, let's say, the late, what would that be? That would have been the 80s, toward the late 80s when finally,
right.
Is it reminiscent of that?
Well, yes and no. Again, there we go again, see? Being the good economist. Yes, in as much as it's a lot of money flowing onshore very quickly, and if you look at some of the prices being paid and some of the deals being done, you almost might question, are these really good investments? I'm thinking, of course, the $2 billion purchase of the Waldorf Astoria that came out just the other day, which I think most external people look at and go, what? What are you thinking, right? I mean, that's a lot of money to be putting into a relatively old hotel. Now, of course, there's some nuance to that story that's been coming out since, but nevertheless, that just seems like stupid cash, as the case may be. But, and this is an enormous but, it's different in as much as the money coming out of Japan in the late 80s was, of course, due to that massive financial bubble in Japan at the time that gave them all this kind of funny money to play with. You remember back in the late 80s, at the height of that boom at one point in time, things had gotten so out of hand that there were estimates that suggested that Tokyo, the land in Tokyo, was worth as much as all the land in the United States combined, or something insane like that. I mean, it was so far off the charts as to be ridiculous. The money coming out of China is not based on some sort of massive financial bubble going on over there. It's the actual creation of real wealth being generated by the second largest economy in the world, growing at a 7, 8, 9% pace. It's, in other words, it's not going to come to a halt when the Shanghai indice collapses or property prices in China collapses, because candidly, there's no evidence that those numbers are terribly overvalued right now.
Okay.
So it's different on that front. It's more sustainable, let me put it that way.
So you don't feel like China has a real estate bubble? I guess I just want to...
No, not really. And I realize it's a controversial thing to say, but there's a couple ways of thinking about this. One way is, are property prices in China truly overvalued? And for the most part, the answer doesn't seem to be yes to that. Yes, property prices have come up, but so have rental prices, so have incomes. And indeed, when you consider like some of the basics fundamentals I might look at in California, say price-to-rent ratios, price-to-income ratios, the numbers don't seem terribly troubling. equivalently, they don't use a lot of mortgage debt. Indeed, most debt in China is either industry debt or equivalently, it's government, local government debt. And the local government situation is a little weird. But household debt's not very much. It's fairly small. It's not like here in the U.S. where we had all this crazy funny money pouring into real estate, blowing things out of proportion. And while it is true that they have overbuilt in many cities, the cities that are overbuilt are not the cities that are terribly overvalued, but have seen huge increases of value. Indeed, the cities that have seen the biggest increase in values tend to be the ones that don't have empty property. And I'm thinking of places like Beijing and Shanghai, right. Places that really don't have this giant excess supply that people are worried about. So, you know, and I'm not pretending to be an expert on the Chinese markets, but the reports I've read, which are fairly middle ground and are taking a very data-oriented approach, which is what I like, have given me the information that suggests to me that the situation is not dire. There's not going to be an imminent meltdown over there.
Okay.
Now, that's good news, but, you know, China still has a lot of other problems they have to deal with. And it seems clear to me that some of those problems are very likely to be why they're experiencing the slowdown. I mean, it's not the cheapest place in the world to do business anymore. It is a nation that does not have very good institutions, does not have a very clear rule of law. They have terrible corruption problems at many different levels. So they have challenges ahead. There's no doubt about it. I just don't think that this may be one of them we really have to worry about.
You know, we're winding down the QE efforts, and we land today at below 2.2% for a 10-year T-bill.
So, yeah, how about that? Huh? Now, who told you that wasn't good? Don't worry about quantitative easing last year. I think that was me.
Well, what happened? Everybody's thinking it was going to say way over 3, but there's got to be other reasons why it's at 2.2.
And that's just it. See, quantitative easing never had a dramatic impact on interest rates coming down. And so, therefore, why would the end of quantitative easing have a big impact on them going up again? Look, interest rates were on a strong downward trajectory for years and years before Ben Bernanke got into office, years before quantitative easing was even a gleam in his eye, so to speak. They have been falling because what he termed, at the beginning of his term, the global savings glut. That is to say, we live in a world that is awash with capital relative to the demand for capital. And under those sort of circumstances, you expect a lower interest rate, low return type environment. Well, we're still there. Indeed, if anything, we're even more awash with capital today than we were at the beginning of Ben Bernanke's term. And because of some of those global issues, there still isn't much demand for it. That's a low interest rate environment. As for quantitative easing, I think the most important statistic here is while the headline numbers look pretty scary, the other side of it is this. Of all those trillions of dollars created through QE 1, 2, and 3, 87% of that cash never made it into the economy. It's sitting in the banks in the form of excess reserves. By the way, those excess reserves are officially held by the Federal Reserve. That's not real money. It's just numbers on a spreadsheet somewhere in the center of the central bank. It's not real cash. It has no real influence on the economy.
I'm, you know, this one's over my head. So how do you have borrowed money be reserve capital for banks? Isn't that what you just said?
Well, first of all, the excess reserves we're talking about are not capital.
Okay.
It's not counting towards their
balance sheet.
The balance sheet. No. It's just another form of asset, if you will. I mean, banks can hang on to loans, they can hang on to securities, or they can hang on to cash. In this case, it's just another asset, him hanging on to cash.
Okay. All right. I think I'll save this, some of those questions for when you're on the panel. retirement pension plans then. So you have this low interest rate environment just about when you really need a high yield return for making your promises or keeping your promises. Are we going to stay in this low interest rate environment for a while? And then if that is so, how does that play out when we have to pay people?
Well, yes, we are going to stay in this low interest rate environment for a while for all the reasons I just said. Indeed, what's going to change the low interest rate environment is when we manage to get the Chinese from being the ultimate savers they are. The savings rate in China right now runs in the 40 to 45% range, to give you a sense of that, and turn them into consumers. Because by turning them into consumers, suddenly there's a little less of that capital floating around, which would in turn mean higher interest rates. So, I don't think that's going to change any time in the near future. And indeed, interestingly enough, I gave a talk the other day to an Asian business group here in Southern California called the Asian Business League. And I made this comment, and it was funny because we had a number of people, Chinese nationals, in the room, and I made this idea they had to start consuming. And they said, oh, so you think we should build more homes as opposed to, you know, buying securities? And they go, no, building homes is an investment. I'm talking about consumption. they couldn't even fathom what I was talking about.
Buy a couch.
Because this is, yeah, well, I mean, for this population, they've had such, you know, terrible times economically over the past, you know, 100 years. And so for them, it's always been about savings. And that's tough to break, that kind of cultural phenomenon. We sort of have the opposite problem here in the U.S. because to go back to what your original question was, you said, well, you know, how are we going to, you know, people have to have enough for retirement. What are they going to do? Well, the answer is they have to be a little bit more Chinese. That is to say, they have to start saving.
Yeah. Now,
so it's you know, they need to consume more and we need to save more. And hopefully somewhere in between we'll all end up being in a better place.
Anything surprise you about the lack of volume of sales in California, real estate sales?
Well, first of all, the number's starting to come back up again. If you look at the recent data, it's already starting to bounce forward. But putting it to one side, you have to understand that the numbers you're looking at are not directly comparable today to, say, a year ago. But here's where our real estate market is. We are in this trough, if you will, between the investor and the retail buyer. A few years ago, investors such as yourself figured out something kind of important. You said, gee, rents are expensive, homes are cheap, and people can't get capital. So I'm going to go out because I can get capital. I'm going to buy properties, and I'm going to turn around and I'm going to rent them out. The investors are what drove the first wave of the real estate recovery. Now, and by the way, that explains one of the weird phenomenons here, because you remember a couple of years ago, the home builders got all excited because lo and behold, suddenly prices were up, sales were up, and this means more demand for new homes. Didn't happen this time, which was a big shock to a lot of people's systems out there. Hence, of course, the home builders have been trying to haven't seen the kind of gains they expected to see. That wave is pretty much done. Foreclosures, the crisis, quote-unquote crisis, is gone. People have the market has cleared a lot of that bad debt, and as a result of that, the market has started to cool for the investor because there's just not many cheap units to pick up anymore. Now, what we're waiting for is the next wave, which is going to be the retail buyer, the move-up buyer, the person who owns the house they live in. They're going to sell that, buy another unit, bigger, better, smaller, more convenient, closer to their job, better in a better school district, whatever the case may be, whatever drives that person to move, jump in the market. Now, that has just now started to occur because of a couple things. A, credit's now starting to get easier to get. And on the side of it, of course, is with the price increases that have occurred as driven by this first wave of investors, the first wave of people, the investors into the market, that is creating a situation by which a lot of new equity is now out there for the owners. When the market bottomed out, we went from about $16 trillion in home equity in the U.S. to about $8 trillion. Americans lost $8 trillion of real estate wealth in about 2 years.
Right.
And then since then, it's guess what? It's back up to about $14 trillion. So you have a lot of new money. Suddenly it's easier to get credit. The banks are making it easier. I know it's hard to believe, but if you look at the numbers, suddenly bank holdings of mortgages actually starting to rise. The average FICO score for a Fannie Mae fixed rate, 30-year fixed rate mortgage has dropped from 760 to about 735. So you have all sorts of signs that suggest that credit's easier to get, people have more money to play with, banks are willing to play along, and that means there's a whole second wave in the market, which is going to be coming from again, those move-up buyers. And this time, it's going to have the nice impact of driving new home demand, which you get those construction markets moving again.
We also if you look at California Association of Realtors charts and take a look at the absence of volume, a lot of it is coming in that first-time buyer category. So
right. Well, that goes back to the credit situation. So
Not just that, though. Let's say their capacity is diminished. What about their willingness? Because you mentioned something that was interesting, that you have a whole country that's used to hard times and they don't spend. And we got I got raised by a dad who lived through the Great Depression, and it affected him his whole life. So does a Great Recession taint somebody's willingness, even if they have the capacity?
Oh, come on, really?
No.
You don't believe that?
No, I'm asking.
What your father went through in the Great Depression,
yes,
was really tough. What we just went through compared to that was nothing. Give me a break.
It's all relative.
You're talking about a 10-year period of time, unemployment at the 25 to 30% rate, just massive problems across the board, from deflation to humongous migrations of impoverished populations. Economic output went down by 5%. The unemployment rate reached about 10%. We're already bounced back. We're well above where we were pre-recession. While there are still some people look on the outside looking in, for the vast majority of Americans, things are better today than they were in 2005, for the vast majority of Americans. Nothing happened over the last decade that should traumatize anybody. And to pretend otherwise, I think, is almost an insult to your father and his generation.
Okay. Be that as it may, why are then the millennials really not buying? Is it because they're just not forming households as early as other generations?
Well, again, see, that's my point. That's not actually happening. Indeed, what you're dealing with here is a decline in ownership rates for all age groups, not just for millennials. It certainly is not exclusive to that group alone. I don't know why people keep thinking it is. Really, only for people 65 and above has the ownership rate stayed the same. For everybody else, it's been dropping.
Okay.
Now, as for millennials, yeah, okay, it is true that they look like they may be spending a little more time with their parents. They may be spending a little more time with roommates. But then again, the millennials are getting married later. It's a different kind of generation. They're putting off some of these big life decisions a little bit because they can. And I don't think that represents anything but an ongoing continuation of a long-term trend. And, you know, I'm going to blame you, Bruce. This is your fault, because you boomers have so coddled your children that they want to live at home forever. You see, I'm a Gen Xer. We couldn't wait to get out of the house.
I couldn't
wait. But you boomers have these little spoiled kids, and it's just a different thing completely.
Well, my kids got married at 18, the oldest two, so they must not have been able to stay in my house either.
Oh, well, good. Now I take that back. You're one of the good boomers.
Well, Christopher, I honestly, we're almost out of time. Looking very much forward to having you on the panel. It's an exciting group, and as always, you will add a lot of expertise in your with your range of knowledge, both in real estate and economies, and it'll be an exciting night, and I thank you for taking time to do this for us.
I'm always happy to be there, and I'm looking forward to it very much, Bruce.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate, Adrenaline Athletics, Coldwell Banker Town & Country, Elite Auctions, In A Day Development, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, Investor Experts, Jennifer Buys Houses, Keystone CPA, Las Brisas Escrow, LA South REIA, Lavis Associates, Pilot Limousine, Primary Residential Mortgage, Northern California Real Estate Investors Association, North San Diego Real Estate Investors, Real Wealth Network, Realty 411 Magazine, Rick and Leanne Rossiter, Personal Real Estate Magazine, Sonica Corporation, South Point Companies, Spinnaker Loans, Tony Alvarez, UDirect IRA Services, and the Council of Multiple Listing Services. See isurvivedrealestate.com for video of the live event and more on our sponsors.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.